All right, so yeah, no, Bogey was wrong. We are not always going to have Paris. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, it is the 1st of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are going to play the President of the United States as we get going here about his decision on the Paris climate deal today.
The United States will withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord. Thank you.
Yeah, the applause went on for a while, as did the president. The announcement went about 27, 28 minutes. But about two-thirds of the way through, the president said this, talking, if even perhaps he didn't realize it, about how the American economy has already turned to a low-carbon future. Here you go.
I was elected to represent the citizens of Pittsburgh, not Paris.
Absolutely true. But the fact is, the economic strength of Pittsburgh today is that it has made the turn away from coal and steel. The top employer in that city, according to the state of Pennsylvania, is the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, then the university proper, then in third place, the federal government, then on down the list to 11th place, which is where you finally find U.S. Steel. So with the United States now officially on the sidelines of the fight to control global warming, there is opportunity for others. China and the European Union have already promised to step up. So from the sustainability desk, Marketplace's Jed Kim spent his day reporting on what that might look like.
So just what does the U.S. lose if it's no longer leading the global fight against climate change?
Nothing.
Kevin Book is managing director of the research firm Clearview Energy Partners. He means nothing now, but
it discards optionality that the president and his administration could have to change the shape of the Paris Agreement and change the pace of its enforcement.
Pulling out also sends a strong signal that the U.S. is less interested in the investment opportunities that could arise from the Paris deal. Rob Day is with Spring Lane Capital, which invests in renewable technology.
We're not going to be supporting our companies, our startups, our business leaders, as they seek to try to take advantage of those opportunities.
How big are those opportunities? Andrew Steer is president and CEO of the World Resources Institute.
If you simply add up the commitments under the Paris deal up until 2025, it's about $1 trillion a year of investment that's open for bidding.
And China, eager to be seen as the new global leader on climate change, will push hard for related business opportunities. Carla Freeman directs the Foreign Policy Institute at Johns Hopkins.
China really sees huge economic growth opportunities in taking the lead in global climate change.
Making things like solar panels, wind turbines.
Not only technology sectors, but even in finance. China has launched a whole array of new green finance instruments.
Quite a shift from days not too long ago when China saw emissions caps as hurting growth. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Moving on now to the rest of American capitalism, the part where the federal government pays what it owes. There is something of a tug of war going on within the Trump administration over the debt ceiling, specifically whether Congress ought to do what is called a clean raise, just increase the amount the government can borrow straight up, the choice favored by Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, or whether strings ought to be attached, which is what Budget Director Mick Mulvaney prefers. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains what's going on and why it matters.
Budget Director Mulvaney came to the White House from Congress. He was elected in the Tea Party wave of 2010. He helped found the Freedom Caucus, budget-slashing members of Congress who are now demanding that any increase in the debt limit be paired with spending cuts, just as Treasury Secretary Mnuchin is telling Congress, hey, raise the debt limit already because I'm running out of money.
So you have two different points of view speaking to the president.
That's Steve Bell at the Bipartisan Policy Center. He hopes President Trump will listen to Mnuchin. Bell says, don't politicize the debt by tying it to future spending. That increases the risk that Congress won't raise the debt limit and the government won't be able to pay some bills, say, from a contractor.
Let's say that Lockheed Martin sent in a $20 million bill and it wasn't paid. And therefore, Lockheed Martin couldn't pay the subcontractor.
Also, if the government defaults, it would have to pay more to borrow money, pushing up interest rates for consumers, says Rudolph Panner, a former head of the Congressional Budget Office.
Car loans that affect mortgages, affect your credit card rate, and so on.
And just a long, drawn-out debate over the debt ceiling can spook investors, says Henrietta Trays of Veda Partners.
My clients are already interested in this issue. They're already following it closely and are anxious about its resolution.
Trays says, fine, cut government spending, but first raise the debt limit without the drama that spooks investors. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Lest you think it's only federal finances that are a mess, let us turn now to the great state of Illinois, where the budget crisis deepened a notch today, a notch being the amount by which S&P dropped the state's credit rating to just short of junk. The Illinois legislature ended its spring session yesterday without a complete budget for the second year in a row, leaving taxpayers with $14.5 billion in debt, the lowest credit rating of all the states, and big questions about how to fund all kinds of government services. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has that one.
It's going to be really hard for Illinois to deal with more than $14 billion in unpaid bills. It will require a combination of raising taxes and cutting spending in a big way, which hasn't worked so far, according to Kent Redfield, professor emeritus of political science at the University of Illinois Springfield.
There's no happy ending here in terms of, painless solution.
And bankruptcy isn't an option for states. The problems go back a few years, according to John Humphrey at Girton Municipal Bond Management in Chicago. Humphrey says Republican Governor Bruce Rauner took office in 2015 with billions in debt already on the books. Then came persistent budget clashes with a Democrat-controlled legislature.
That's ultimately where we stand now. So fiscal 16 and fiscal 17 never really had a budget.
Some spending has continued through stopgap measures, court orders, and ongoing appropriations mandated by law that's kept up basic functions like schools. But social services have greatly suffered.
We haven't received any funding since June of 2016.
Angela Bertoni runs Sojourn Shelter and Services. It's a domestic violence shelter serving nearly 7,000 individuals in central Illinois, including children living in crisis.
They don't know whether they're going to walk in and find mom dead or alive.
More than 40% of the shelter's budget comes from the state, and Bertoni says they may have to close if the funding doesn't come through this year. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders didn't care about anything. Seriously, they were just looking for a reason to buy. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Fully a quarter of all the community college students in this country, one in four, are in community colleges in California. And less than half of them finish a degree or get a credential within 6 years, which is a problem because the longer it takes, the more it costs, and the less likely students are to ever finish. So California's community colleges are rolling out a $150 million plan to try to change that, as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports from the Education Desk at WYPR.
21 units is okay, right?
At Mount San Antonio College near L.A., professors and counselors are holed up in a windowless conference room, armed with copies of the course catalog and pads of yellow and blue Post-its. Their job is to map out, semester by semester, all of the classes a student in a given major would need to get an associate's degree in 2 years.
That route's going to get to 22 units. This path won't work.
At Mount SAC, as the community college is nicknamed, 2 years is not the norm. Many students work and take classes part-time. Only about half finish a degree or transfer to a four-year college within 6 years. Eloy Ortiz Oakley is chancellor of the California Community College System. He says the traditional cafeteria-style approach has encouraged students to sort of wander through college, taking a little of this, a little of that.
So their experience turns into a 6 and 7 year experience because those first 2 or 3 years, they're still trying to figure out what courses to take. And many of those classes don't lead to the major that they choose.
Under pressure from students and lawmakers to change that, the whole California system, all 113 community colleges, is moving to an approach known as guided pathways. The idea is to help students choose a course of study earlier, then give them a clear roadmap to get to their goal.
We want to make sure that when a student comes to our campus, they know what courses they need to take to get to their educational outcome, and that we are organized in a way that makes it easy for them to take those courses.
the approach has shown promise at colleges in Florida, Tennessee, and New York. At Mount SAC, the overwhelming choice started from the very first contact with potential students when they tried to choose a program on the college's website. Don Shore is Associate Dean of Instruction.
And you click on the drop-down, and the drop-down goes on and on and on and on.
200 programs in all in a scrolling list.
If I'm a student new to the whole college world, what am I going to do here?
So the college started by sorting those 200 programs into 8 career clusters, like aviation, electronics, and manufacturing. That's one cluster. Health, wellness, and public service is another. Students will choose a cluster early on, then take basic courses related to the field before deciding on a major.
That's why I'm writing Math 110.
At the mapping session, professors team up with staff from the counseling office to create the suggested pathways to those majors. Health science professor Kelly Correas works with counselor Elana Bakor to map the respiratory therapy program.
Then the arts, they just need one from this list here.
Correas tentatively picks ceramics as a recommended arts course because respiratory therapists have to work with their hands. But then she has second thoughts.
I wouldn't want to pin a student down to taking ceramics if they were really interested in world architecture. You know, I want to give them that opportunity to explore because I also think that that's part of what college is about, is that exploration.
Officials say there will still be plenty of opportunities for students to explore if they want to. But students like 27-year-old Janelle Yanez, who's studying fire science, want a plan.
I'm always willing to learn something new that's not even part of my plan, but if it's not steering me in a direction to a career, then it's not beneficial for me.
While exploration might be fun and even life-changing, at today's college prices, it's also expensive. In Walnut, California, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
We've been doing an occasional series the past year and a half or so, maybe 2 years, actually, based on the idea that whatever the headline numbers say, the economy is only as good as the people living in it think it is, how it feels to them. It's called My Economy, and here's today's installment.
My name is Sherry Messer, and I am in Austin, Texas. I am the chief family officer. I'm a stay-at-home mom, and we've really enjoyed that. My oldest son is 10 now, so I've, for the most part, not been working for 10 years. We're comfortable and happy, but then there's this kind of unknown, and we know, like, we're aware that things could change. I have a master's degree, and I'm nervous about getting back into the workforce. I left the workforce about the time the iPhone was really coming out and becoming prevalent. And so much has changed. I want to contribute. I mean, I grew up like thinking about career, not about having kids. But then all of a sudden, you're at that point in life and you haven't planned in that way. You've planned career. I was a director at a nonprofit. Whatever I do next needs to be meaningful to me because it's going to be taking time away from the family. I want the best of both worlds. I want a really great career, but I want to raise my family and be there for them.
That was Sherry Messer. We got her, as she said, in Austin, Texas. Take a second. Send us the story of your economy. If you get a minute, there is a place you can do that at marketplace.org/myeconomy. Coming up.
It had to be kind of on extreme terms and say, like, no, it's going to be all or nothing.
A movie director who knows what she wants. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 135 points today, about 0.6% on the blue chips, 21,144. NASDAQ up 48 points, 0.7%, 62.46. S&P 500 up 18 points, also 0.7%, 24.30. Energy companies were all right with today's news. Chevron up 0.7%, Phillips 66, topped off with 0.6%, Antero Resources, natural gas there, lifted 0.2%. Today, dozens of CEOs urged President Trump to stay in the Paris Agreement. Among the companies that signed today's full-page newspaper ad to that effect, Morgan Stanley up 2%, Apple up 0.2%, Pacific Gas and Electric generated 0.7% to the good today. The Dakota Access Pipeline is fully operational as of today. Its owner, Energy Transfer Partners, saw its stock rise 0.8%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.21%. And you're listening to Marketplace. Hi, everybody. It's Kai Rizdahl. Marketplace is here because these days it's essential to have an independent source explaining how the economy really works, not just for CEOs, but for everybody. Your support keeps this kind of reporting coming, and it's especially vital now at the end of our fiscal year. So please visit marketplace.org/donate to contribute and to keep us in your world every day. And thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. With immigration in the news as it has been, there's also been a rise in the number of immigrants seeking advice on how to stay on the right side of the law. Often, though, those immigrants turn to people who don't necessarily have their best interests at heart. The city of Philadelphia is trying to do something about that, as Emma Jacobs reports.
Ricardo Mejia runs a business that offers help translating documents and filling out forms, from divorces to immigration paperwork. But he recently put up a new sign in the waiting room of his office.
In English and Spanish.
It clarifies that Mejia is not a lawyer and cannot give legal advice.
I'm not allowed to provide assistance either. So what I can do is just fill out forms based on information provided by the customer.
The sign was required by a 2014 Philadelphia city law regulating non-attorneys advertising immigration services. Mejia says he wasn't aware of it until he got a visit from Philadelphia's Commerce Department. Gwendolyn David is a business services manager at the city. She began visits this year to inform people of the rules, which also include listing their fees up front for all services.
So when you come in, you know that you're going to pay that exactly amount for that. Like if you were going to McDonald's, you see your menu of what you're going to pay.
The law targets a long-standing problem that the American Bar Association has noted in immigrant communities around the country. Businesses promising help with immigration applications that have, in some cases, taken advantage of clients or just offered bad advice. Vanessa Stein worked with Philadelphia to craft the law and on its implementation. She says the new enforcement activity is well-timed to the start of the Trump administration.
People are proactively seeking out legal help and representation that have never had legal consultations in the United States before.
Stein is a staff attorney at Friends of Farm Workers, a Philadelphia nonprofit. She says that in Hispanic communities, non-lawyers advertising help with immigration services may refer to themselves as notarios, a word that in many Latin American countries refers to someone with legal training. In the U.S., many immigrants find attorneys' fees very high, and nonprofits like Stein's that offer pro bono assistance have long waiting lists. So notarios, often located right in immigrant neighborhoods, can seem like accessible, attractive options. But clients may end up losing money or even face deportation if a notario advised them to file the wrong application.
Some people really do mean well, but they don't understand.
Miriam Enriquez leads Philadelphia's Office of Immigrant Affairs. And while she said some notarios may make well-intentioned mistakes,
I do believe that there are people that know exactly what they're doing, that they know that this is a population who is vulnerable, who is very desperate to get right with the law, that they make them promises that they very well know that they cannot keep.
And their clients, especially those living in the U.S. illegally, may be very reluctant to report problems to law enforcement, making this type of fraud what Enriquez refers to as the perfect crime. The city will respond to complaints by fining businesses and referring serious violations to law enforcement. But the other key step, Enriquez says, is community education, getting the word out to immigrants that they need to be careful when seeking help, because the wrong help can hurt. In Philadelphia, I'm Emma Jacobs for Marketplace.
Wonder Woman hits theaters today, directed by a woman and starring a woman. But there is another movie opening this weekend, a much smaller film to be sure, with its own statement about gender and female characters and women who make movies. It's called Band Aid. Zoe Lister-Jones, who you might know from television, Life in Pieces on CBS, wrote, produced, and directed. Thanks for coming into the studio.
Thanks for having me.
Why did you want to make this movie?
Well, I think I've always been interested in kind of the inner workings of long-term relationships. I'm a child of divorce, so I think those themes have always been something that have kind of confounded me, why couples choose to stay together and how they do that. And I also love writing songs, and I knew that I wanted to find a story that had music at its center. So it was sort of the convergence of those two things that led to a couple who fights through songs.
And try to heal themselves through song. I mean, that's that's the thing. You roll through to the end credits of this thing, the first thing is written, produced, and directed by Zoe Lister-Jones, which meant you had all kinds of control over this thing, obviously. And one of the things you did was you hired an all-female crew.
Yeah.
Tell me about that decision.
Well, I think in my experience, both in front of the camera and behind it, I had become very aware of the underrepresentation of women on film and TV crews. And I think on top of that, I also have found in my own life that something kind of inexplicably magical happens when women come together. And I wanted to see what it would feel like. I could have this sort of creative social experiment, but also offer opportunities to women in departments where they're rarely given them.
Was it a different kind of set?
Very different, yeah. The energy was markedly different from any set I had ever been on. And every actor who came on set would immediately remark that this was something really different. You know, it was a very nurturing and supportive and communicative set, but it was also highly efficient. You know, not only was were we all really taking ownership over the work and kind of everyone was a visionary in their own right, but everyone was so anticipatory of what anyone else might need at any moment in the way that many women can be. And yeah, I found it remarkable. And there's a band in the movie called The Dirty Dishes that Adam and Fred and I are in. And we just recorded a music video.
Oh, did you really? Oh, that's great.
For our first single. And I hired an all-female crew for that too. And so it was really nice to continue on that track and kind of just start to settle into it as more of the norm, at least for my productions.
What's it going to be like then when you go back to television as the season starts and it's not all female?
You know, I mean, I had to do that last season because we shot a year ago. And there are so many men that I love working with, and it's not at all an indictment of men. But I do think that the system is broken, you know, and I think that there's been a lot more discourse around inequities in our industry, gender inequities. But I don't see enough action being taken. So I feel like, for me, at least, in order to really subvert the paradigm, it had to be kind of on extreme terms and say no, it's going to be all or nothing. Because I think when you set out to say I'm going to hire as many women as possible, you end up with the same ratio because the cards are just stacked too much against us in terms of she doesn't have as much experience as that guy, or you know, relationships that are existing that people want to continue to
and that's the pipeline thing that you hear in corporate America, you hear it in Silicon Valley, you hear it all over the place. And so if you go in with the mindset of it's going to be everybody.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think it's just about understanding that the quote-unquote risk that might be taken in hiring someone who might have less experience or who you might have never worked with before is sort of imperative right now.
Zoe Lister-Jones, the film is called Band Aid, opens tomorrow. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
This final note today to be filed under things you were pretty sure had already happened. From the desk of Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, his signature on a bill designating cheese as that state's official dairy product. I know, right? Cheese is like their thing. Milk is already the official beverage. The dairy cow is the official domestic animal. America's Dairyland is on Wisconsin license plates. And don't even get me started on those things Green Bay Packers fans wear on their heads. Cheese. I know it's cheese they wear on their heads. I know that. Cheese heads. The Dow up 135 points today, about 0.6%. 21,144. NASDAQ up 48 points, about 0.7%. S&P 500 jumped 18 points, 0.7%. John Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, Suzanne Levy, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Troe are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor is John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.